Hi, y'all. Katie Parker, alcoholic. Hey. Wow, is it good to be here. I've been sober since October the 28th of 1984, and this year has been 40 years, and I'm just blown away. I know. Blown away. You know, 20 was a big deal, 30 was a big deal, but there's something about 40, which means it's like, how old am I? Wow. Bob always said, the body gets older, but the mind stays young. I'm hanging on to that. I'm trying to keep this body as young as I can, but let me tell you, I'm 67, and something around 64, yeah, thank you. You can do all kinds of stuff to yourself these days to keep your, trust me. And I've done it. I've done it all. I am a little out of sorts, and I typically am not out of sorts. And I'm out of sorts because this was Charlie's last talk and 2 years ago. And the truth of the matter is I called Glenn, and I said, Glenn, I think you guys want me to do the third step was a bad idea. And he goes, you recommended it. Really? So I'll just start off by saying I'm doing okay. It's challenging. Some days are better than others. But I would love to really not make this all about Charlie. It's kind of one of those things where you just kind of come in and, you know, I know that people would like to say, you know, oh, Charlie's talked this and it's almost overwhelming. And so I think that's why I'm a little out of sorts right now, because I'm just in some fear that you can go down a dark hole if you're not careful with grief. And Marty said, my sponsor told me one time, she said, you know, Katie, there's a fine line between sorrow and self-pity, and you got to be careful not to drift into that. And I really do recommend that, you know, because life is good. Life is very, very good. And I've never seen, we go to thousands of conferences. There's never have I seen one attended like this on a Friday night. So give yourself a big hand. I mean, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. I missed the young man before me, and because it took a while to do this. So, and when I walked in, I thought, oh my God, there are so many people here. This is really the real AA. You know what I mean? Conferences are huge. They're important. They're a part of the unity, a part of the fellowship, and I absolutely love them. So it's an honor to be here. My job is to talk about the third step, which I love the third step. I misunderstood this third step for a long time. At about 17 years sober, Charlie and I both woke up. I know you probably know this, but he had 5.5 years less than I did. I mean, 5.5 months less than I did, and I reminded him of that frequently. It's kind of one of those things where you say, oh, honey, it'll make a little bit more sense to you in about 5.5 months. So just hang in there with me. He and I were so deeply competitive. A lot of people couldn't have handled what Charlie and I had together. And I mean, we had so much brother-sister stuff that it was like, who can get to the front door first? Who can brush their teeth faster? Crazy stuff. But the truth of the matter is I loved having a little bit more time than him. I would not have wanted it the other way around. But the third step, we woke up, my sponsor's Marty Ruby, and she was the one who took me through the third step and woke me up to this understanding of something that I didn't know. And there's no blame in my game. I mean, there were plenty of people talking about the book, plenty of people talking about the 12 and 12. I just wasn't interested. It was back in the 80s. Codependency group therapy was a big deal. Your inner child work was crucial. And I have worked this inner child well. But the cool thing about that is I use all of that for the good. So I used everything for the good. There was nothing done that was wrong or bad or nobody did. I'm no blamer here. I just didn't pay attention to what else was going on. And so when I got sober, I chased a boy into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. He had 6 years and I had 10 minutes. It was a match made in heaven. You know, and it's kind of, you gotta have some game to land somebody with 6 years when you got 10 minutes, and I did. But we both had the same sobriety date. He just had it 6 years before me, so it's kind of interesting how all this plays out. But one of the things that happened to me was, a woman took me in the kitchen and gave me a real first step experience, physical allergy, mental obsession, and I thought, well, I must be it. And But then we just went on our knees and did the third step prayer and kind of missed that body of work. And I had the book. I could have read it myself and found it out myself. But the truth of the matter is I think it is a bit misunderstood. And so I'm going to go into explaining my understanding of the third step. I think too, sobriety time is very important. You know, between 18 months and 3 years, I think that particular individual is still, they don't understand that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our trouble, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. That's just the nature of it. You wouldn't hand a 7-year-old the car keys and say, you know, run down and get me a pack of cigarettes. But, I mean, and you wouldn't expect somebody with 18 months to 3 years to grasp this because they just don't have the spiritual development yet. And that's just the facts. And then but typically between 3 and 5, you start really waking up to what that is. And then between 5 and 7, it gets really bumpy, if you ask me. You're starting to get into what I call the teenage years, and it's the know-it-all. I know. And that's okay, too. And the reason I say this is because I went through every one of these phases. So I know exactly what that feels like and what that looks like. And something else I want to mention, I had misunderstood the date of this event, and I don't know why. I guess I thought since Charlie was at it 2 years ago that our schedule was open, but this happens to be the big man-to-man weekend conference, and Charlie was such the camp coordinator. And so we had, Bob has spent the night at our house. We have, I had 50 men at the house last night, so we had this big, huge event to kick off man-to-man, and they spend the night. I mean, we got blow-up beds all over the place. And I told them there's two things in my life that I love to do. And one is to go to the National Shooting Complex and shoot sporting clays and the man-to-man conference. And they pulled it off, and it was absolutely spectacular. So I left all those guys, jumped on the plane, got here as quick as I could. And they're all calling me, you know, so how's it going? Is everything fine? My flight was good. We're all good. Everything's good. But they were putting, I said, now, God dang it, you guys put up all that blow-up bed. I want to come home to a clean house. So, and it's all the boys. So, you know, you got to tell them that about 4 times. But clean it up. Clean it up. But, you know, in AA, you don't have to tell most of us to clean up. We do that now. There's just something about that feel of being in recovery that I just love. So we're talking about this maturity, right? This spiritual maturity is a game changer. And I think you have to also realize that you have to go hit flat spots, hit walls. You got to hit all these things in order to grow, because pain is really the touchstone of growth. Right? I mean, if I'm living in enlightenment all the time, I'm not really thinking, wow, I need to do another inventory or whatever. So sometimes it requires hitting that wall before you can begin to move forward. So, you know, it says in the fifth step, it says, after we have swallowed and digested large chunks of truth about ourselves, that we will be delighted that we know our Creator better. So, I mean, that's a little bit of an oxymoron, right? You know, I'm swallowing and digesting, I should be happy. Not always, you know. So that's kind of one of the things that understanding this third step and going a little bit deeper. Kip Collins used to say it's easier to get an alcoholic to stop drinking than it is to get one of us to quit playing God. And that is so true. You know, you'd think that would be the harder task, but it's just not. See, alcohol was the solution. It wasn't the problem. You know, leaving aside the drink problem, we had to look at what the root of the problem was. And I remember the first time I really heard that at 17 years. I'm sure somebody was saying it before then, but I just didn't hear it. You know, we hear it when we hear it. And I remember thinking, I thought the not drinking was the finish line. And then I get my act together and I get life together and all of that works better. Doesn't work that way. The thing about self-reliance and self-will for me is I like it. I like running the show. I mean, you know, I swear, somebody goes, Katie, we need you over here. Of course you do. Thank you. Yes. Well, what do you need me to do? Because I can, you need these people to quiet down? I can get that to happen. I like it. It says the first requirement is that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Now ask yourself, do you really believe that? I mean, I get a lot of stuff done. I did really, really well in business. I mean, I think I was a good mom. My kids still love me. That's a good thing. And so I was not convinced of that. And I remember the first time I read that, I thought, well, that's just silly. I mean, what am I supposed to just be, you know, dud? And that's not at all what it's talking about, right? It's talking about, first of all, I got to wake up to what self-reliance looks like. Because this is all terminology I didn't get. If it says selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our troubles, we are driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows. Now it's getting interesting. They retaliate, seeming without provocation. But I invariably find that sometime in the past, I made a decision based on Katie that put me in this predicament. But see, I don't see it that way. I just think, Mary's pissed off at me. That's about as far as I go. I mean, I can start really running down some ideas in my head. Maybe I was gossiping about her and somebody told her. I said, whatever, whatever, whatever. So I'm going to go 9 miles down a road before I can realize it. And that's where, if I call Marty and I start telling her about it, she starts to walk the dog backwards. And then I begin to see where I made a decision, and I didn't even realize I'd made that decision. So 99% of the time, the problem is me, which is tough sometimes. It's a difficult task to just, you know, realize that maybe I did say something that upset somebody. And then the beauty of the amends process, right? So when it says sometimes they hurt us, seeming without provocation, but invariably we find that we made that decision based on self, is a gift. And I've begun to learn that that is a gift, right? When I see that I'm a hypocrite, that between the third column and the fourth column of a resentment inventory is that I could have done the same thing to somebody that somebody did to me, right? I could be either person in this play. And I think sometimes that's really important for me to see that the freedom comes with knowing that I'm a hypocrite. It was one time Charlie and I were driving to the airport, and this guy in an Escalade comes screaming in, scared the crap out of me. And I immediately thought, I could have been either person. I could have been the guy in the Escalade, and I could have been the person in the car that got scared. So I gave you a little bit more slack when that happens. That's the way I see the process work. And it doesn't really require that much of me to be looking a little bit deeper, right? The beauty of inventory, and I'm an inventory writing girl. I like to write inventory because I'm a hothead. I am a mess. If somebody doesn't keep their thumb on me. I mean, it can be, do I have anybody in the room that gets that? Okay, well, 7 of y'all raised your hand, so. The rest of you are already living in enlightenment, right? So, it's funny because, you know, I can jot down an inventory and get only to the third column before I see that I'm a hypocrite and I could be either person. And that frees me up because, for me, a resentment is a small granule of salt, sand, and it begins to just drop. And before you know it, I am edgy, just really edgy. And that's what I find the freedom comes from. You know, on page 60, it says we are at step 3, and that's italicized, right? And over on page 63, it says we are now at step 3. I think the beginning of the italic words is getting us, telling us what that third step really is. And then the second part of it is affirming what the third step, you know, the prayer is the affirmation of what the third step is really about. It says that we decided to turn our will and our thoughts over to the care of God as we understand Him, right? This cause and effect. In life, cause and effect, spiritual laws, all these things are at play. So I thought life was coming at me, but it's really coming from me. And see, it's kind of one of those things that if you get scared, say you're afraid you're going to lose your job, you make a lot of mistakes at work with that fear. You're driven by that fear, you will make a lot of mistakes. And the thinking mind is really the tricky thing. Since I'm alone in the house, I will tell you it is very interesting to have such a quiet environment. I don't really care much for it. I'd take back every defect of character Charlie had. It's like, okay, come back. I see it now. Doggone it. But the truth of the matter is it forced me to have to look deeper into me because I didn't like the feeling I was having. And don't get me wrong. I know grief is this and grief is that. But it got me to, my practice now is learning to live in the moment. So right now, the moment is me talking to you guys. It's not what I'm going to have to eat after this. It's not who I need to call after this. It is the present moment. And I'm telling you, it has been the greatest gift ever, but it's an extremely difficult practice. We can talk all about it, but the truth of the matter is to really put it into action requires a lot. And I've been doing it because what was happening is I was so overwhelmed after everything happened that I couldn't remember where I'd laid my keys, where I'd laid my phone. And I don't know, you probably don't know this, but my house flooded a month after Charlie died. The water heater busted in the middle of the night, and I woke up to 8 inches of water through my house and couldn't figure out how to turn the water off. And this guy goes, "You know, there's an emergency shutoff." That's where I was. No shit. Really, where is that? Well, I am a woman. Does any woman in here know where the emergency shutoff is? We got 3-4 women. Okay, well, next time I'll call you. Oh, I swear. It was one of those moments where you're standing there thinking, this is not happening. And so needless to say, I had to redo the whole house. So I don't know where my black Sharpie pen is, because everything had to be demolished. And so I was finding myself really frustrated. I'm telling you, bad. And I thought, what is happening? I've got to slow this thing down so that I can get to where my keys are. And I got to tell you guys, the practice, once again, the pain has forced me into this practice. And I'm so grateful, so, so grateful. You know, it also warns me about, you know, we're almost always in collision with somebody or something, even though our motives are good. And I've always used the same examples, you know, letting somebody in traffic and you expect the wave, or holding the door. Now, that one still bugs the crap out of me. If I hold the door, I'm going to try not to get on a tangent about the younger generation. That's a big problem for me. But, you know, they'll just walk through on their phone and never look up or anything. And I'm like, oh, I'd just do anything if I could just kick your heel out from behind you. Take you down. This little girl got on the plane today. I'm really disturbed by the lack of the loss of the art of communication. I'm very concerned, actually. This girl gets on the plane, and she's probably 23, and it was one of the smaller flights, you know, to get here. It's not the big 737, and she makes no eye contact with me, and then she sits right to my right and wads up in a ball. And I thought, are you okay? And you could just sense the vibe of, don't talk to me, nothing. I mean, there's a vibe that you can give somebody where you're like, yeah. And that's it. Okay, fine. I see you don't want to talk. But I mean, this wadded up in this ball had me so disturbed. I thought of many things I could do. And then I, of course, let her alone. But, I thought I could scare her. That'd be fun. It's terrible. My mind goes to too many dark places, I can tell you that. Then I sat on the other flight next to a woman my age, and we talked the whole time. And I like that sometimes. Some of you guys don't like to talk. I know you don't, but at least you make eye contact, smile, and just shut it down. This is so, so, so interesting. It says I'm the actor running the whole show. I'm forever trying to arrange the lights, the valet, and the scenery. See, that little girl, for some of you guys, wouldn't have bugged you at all. But maybe for some of you, you would have been okay with it. To me, I think that every moment of wherever we are is a moment that God has set up for me, and that I'm supposed to at least say hello, maybe make some eye contact, stand in a line and, you know, get to know somebody in a line, neat T-shirt, you know. I went to the shooting complex. We had a big shoot Wednesday in San Antonio, and this a younger kid was there, and he kept dropping the F-bomb, which at this event, you just don't do that. And at one point I said, buddy, man, you are really dropping that F-bomb too much. This is a little uncomfortable. And the guy that was trapping said, he just looked at me and nodded like that, because this is not the crowd. This is a crowd that doesn't do that. And he goes, is that really bothering you? And I thought, oh, that's where we're going to go? Because, well, I can go there with you, brother. I said, yeah, that's why I said something. And so it got kind of quiet, and then the next station we went to, he said, ma'am, I need to tell you, if my mother was here, she'd kick my ass for said that. And I said, well, good for you. And he goes, I am really sorry. And I said, it's no big deal, buddy. I just wanted to tell you, just, you know, slow it down. So then a little while later, he said, it's a miracle that I'm here. And I said, really? I said, how old are you? He said, 31. And I said, why is that? And he said, I just got a liver transplant. Now, what are the odds that that would be something that this young man had just gotten? He had that hepatitis that you just get, you know, not from a blood transfusion, not from shooting dope, just got it. And I said, and he lifted up his shirt, and it was the same scar that Charlie had had. And it was interesting because I thought, you know, there's purpose in this moment. And I thought, I'm grateful this man at 31 years old gets to live his life. And, you know, and I mean, it was really kind of, it was just kind of sweet. And so, you know, once again, it started with a challenging conversation, but it ended up well. So if I'm the actor running the whole show, how does that look, right? I always want to stay awake and aware in life to the person pulling up next to me in their car. I mean, I love that. I love saying, what's here for me, God? Who do you want me to smile at? Who do you want me to see? What do you want me to talk about? I like to give people a moment of my time. I think that's really important. We get into the hustle and bustle of life, and we miss some of the greatest things. I got a sponsee that she's a bit sniffy, and she's a sniffy one. And I told her, I said, you know, try this practice. Just try it, for God's sakes. And she called me back. She'd gone on vacation. She called me back. She said, Katie, I am blown away. She said, I was talking to everybody. I stopped and visited with everybody. And I said, did you see that it was very divinely inspired? She goes, yes, I did. I couldn't believe it. And I thought, there you go. It's hard to get people to understand because some people go, oh, I just don't like that. Well, then you just dismiss it and you just don't do it. You know, try it. It's really remarkable. So when we get out of here, just look around at some people and make some eye contact. Smile at them, right? Because this, if I'm forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, and the scenery, what does that look like? Well, I really am the sheriff of the world. I am the first responder. If there is, you know, if there is an animal on the side of the road, I'm saving it. I just saved a little kitten on a major four-lane road. It ran right under the Lincoln. I stopped. I thought I'd hit it. And there was nobody behind me. I jump out of the car. This guy comes this way, and he stops. And then all of a sudden, I have to stop traffic, and I'm in my fitness apparel, which is, Charlie says, never very much clothing. And it, I will give you that. It was very little clothing. But I jump out of my car, and I look at the guy, and he says, the kitty's up in my wheel well. And, oh, yeah, and it was just, you know, like this. And so a guy blows his horn. Oh, and I'm on my earbud talking to a sponsee. And this guy blows his horn. Oh, that was not good. I was wrapped tight already. And I mean, I looked at him and gave him a very ugly statement. And he goes, you know, I thought, excuse me, should we tell you what we're doing? We've stopped in the middle of the road, dude. Something serious has happened. Give me about 8 seconds, okay? Guy hands me some gloves. I grabbed that kitty and I held it up like Mufasa. Boom, boom, boom. It was the best. And its little tail was severed, so I take it to the emergency room, and $1,500 later, Charlie would not have been happy about that one. Hey, how much was that? It's $1,500. Yeah, he got just sniff it right off. But we called him, I had to give him to somebody, but we called him Billy Willie Butthole. He was a pistol. So I have always known I'm the first responder. I have that in my blood. I really think, I don't really believe in reincarnation, but I believe I was in the military. And I was in special forces. I was not just an enlisted man. I was something big. And I just feel like I need to be the one on the scene taking charge. And for whatever reason, Charlie said I did it really, really well. You know, wherever we went, it was like, over here, over here. When my daughter was going to college, it was mayhem in the dorm. And there was two sets of stairs going up, one on this side and one on that side. And everybody was kind of knocking into each other. You know, I whistle, I get everybody's attention. This is the one that goes up. That's the one that goes down. We got to get this together. And I swear to God, it was, people follow my direction. I'm very fortunate there. I like that a lot. But it doesn't work well for me other times, right? When the waiter got me upset and I storm into the kitchen after him. Now it's me and untreated alcoholism. I can tell you there's some ugly times. Charlie and I, you know, it's funny because we're just kind of hypocritical. And one of the things about being hypocritical, oh, my little timer went off. Lee, how were we doing? I think I Oh, I didn't have it. Owen Lee's not there. He's left. He's left the building. Give me a minute. I must have hit it with my elbow. Oh, and now I got the alarm. Now I got the stopwatch. Okay, it's back. I know how much time I'm at. You don't want a speaker not knowing where they're at. Be here for days. Charlie, and you know, talking about the hypocrite, I'm all over the place. Work with me on this one. Talking about the hypocrite, in Austin, they started putting bike lanes everywhere. And I mean everywhere. Now, if you're a cyclist, lucky you, okay? I'm not a cyclist. So Charlie and I are just whining and just so disappointed because, you know, Lance Armstrong was from Austin. So we got bike lanes everywhere. It's taken up the whole road. Charlie decides he wants to get healthy. So we're going to go buy a bike. And, of course, he's going to buy the $1 million bike. I'm going to buy the Schwinn. It's like, this isn't going to last long because I know Charlie. We're going to ride twice and then hang it up in the garage. And I swear to God, we rode in that bike lane, and all of a sudden the bike lane ended, and we were complaining why there wasn't any more bike lanes. So those are the interesting things in life I like to look at, right? One time my brother comes in. My family is a lot. We're yellers. My last name was Ostermeller, and we were called the Oster Yellers. We just yelled. That's what we did in my family. And I actually am very comfortable with it. Some people are extremely disturbed by it. Charlie's family was very, very quiet. But when they got upset, they took a knife and just cut your throat. They'll get you to shut up, I can tell you that. And my brother was in the kitchen with me, and this is what my brother did. He goes, "Kate!" I'm like, "I'm right here, Mike, standing right here." And he was saying something about the electric salt shaker. And we got in a bad dust-up. I mean, screaming at each other. And Charlie's head blows off. And I looked at him and I thought, you know what? He just can't stand the yelling. And it's my brother and we're going to yell. That's what's going to happen here. And he busts out into the garage and I go out there and I go, "What is wrong with you, Charlie? It's just my brother and I yelling. That's what we grew up on. Did that make you uncomfortable?" And he goes, "I don't like a man yelling at my wife." I didn't see it going there. I said, "Well, that changes everything then." See, I see something, I think I know what it is, and I react out of it, right? This thought-react world is not at all out of character for us in here, right? And we are quite know-it-alls, right? We think we know it all. And I actually do. So, there you go. Big fan of knowing it all. So it says, if only my arrangements would stay put, right? If only everybody would do as I wish, the show would be great. Right? I can't seem to get it. So you've got my motives, which are stellar, my actions, which are also stellar, and then we just filter it through that delusion, and I think everything's going to work out right. And it just doesn't do it. And if I screw up, I'm going to explain to you what I was thinking so that maybe that will lessen the blow of you being pissed off at me. Sometimes it works really well for me. And then it talks about that toolkit of self-will, right? And trying to make these arrangements. I may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, modest, and self-sacrificing. Then I don't get my way, I'll turn on you. Mean, egotistical. And here's something about that. Charlie and I were so much the yin and the yang. See, I can talk about Charlie all day. You just can't. Okay? I'll make that very clear. Very, very clear. I don't know what it is when people start telling me something about Charlie. I'm like, okay, we're done. We're done here. It's the weirdest place I'm in. We were so much coming at you, a lot of energy coming at you, the yin and the yang. And when we get to Southwest, we were like, you know, just can't wait to meet the girl behind the counter, and this new chick goes, "Yeah, come on." And we always have our bags too heavy, right? Charlie whining about my bag at 51 pounds, his was 52. Okay, so. And one time we were going to the Music City Roundup, and Steve Lee goes, "You realize this is just a weekend." It's like, we got bags. So we get up, and we hadn't met this woman at the Southwest counter, and I put my bag on there. It's 51 pounds. She goes, "Ma'am, that's a pound over." I said, "I know. I just can't hit that 50 mark." She goes, "No, you'll have to fix that." Well, I'm really quite taken back. And I'm not the girl that opens her bag at the airport. So I unzip it, and I reach in there, and I get my curling iron out. And I stick it in my bag, and, you know, the cord's hanging down. And Charlie and I were like, we're not being nice to her anymore. That did not go well. So Charlie sticks his bag up there, and it's 52. And I thought, oh, this should be good. He's a bit more grumpy than I am. And he looked at her, and he goes, for real? You are going to make me take this out and do something? And she said, yes, sir. So he takes his loafer out, and it went down to 51, and she let that go. And he stuffed it in the top of his briefcase, and we're standing there so angry. Now, you do hear we broke the rules, but the rules do not apply to us. So just so be sure you're all catching this story. So we go walking away, and I looked at Charlie, and I said, well, we'll never go back to that chick again. And then all of a sudden it hit me. It's like, oh, my God, this is the toolkit of self-will. Kind, considerate, patient, generous, just having fun until you tell me I can't do it. And then all of a sudden we don't care for you. Now, I have very expensive scales at the house, and I weigh my bag. I weigh everything because I'm not having that happen at the airport again. And I got it right at 50 pounds, and I'm loading my bag on the deal in the American Airlines thing, and it goes bag over, and it blinks a light. And I thought, oh, and then all of a sudden it popped back to 50, and he goes, how did you do that? I'm good, buddy. I am good. That, I will nail that one in the airport. I don't know how anybody does that. Carry on only. I just can't do that. I try. I can't do it. It's just a defect of character I have, right? So what usually happens, that show doesn't come off very well. Now, this is an interesting part of the third step. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right, right? We go to self-pity. He decides to exert himself more. Now I'm driven by the fear. He becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious. That's that toolkit of self-will. As the case may be, still the play doesn't suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault. That's a good line. He's sure others are more to blame. I mean, when the book says blaming others is as far as most of us ever got, oh my gosh, blame is an easy spot to be in, but very, very blocked. If I start blaming other people for whatever, we live in a day and age where there's a lot of blame going on, a lot of blame. And it separates me spiritually. You know, I don't do any social media. And I do 10-step calls all the time, people calling me with social media. I said, you know, you can turn it off. What a concept. Not look at it. Yeah, if it's causing you that much trouble. Charlie did the Nextdoor Neighbor app, and I thought he was going to have a feud with someone, a woman who, you know, picked up a cat. I was like, and she said, and I did. And I was like, Charlie, why do you get on that app? You know, and he goes, well, I like to bug people. Okay, well, then. That's somewhere in our book. So it says he becomes angry, column 2, indignant, column 3, self-pity, column 4, right there. Boom, boom, boom. You don't even have to put pen to paper sometimes. I'm a big fan of doing 10-step calls. I like 10-step calls. I like to help people that you don't even have to know somebody, right? You can really help somebody through. And so I got back out on the road, and I've been telling people, call me with the 10th step, man. I can help you out, because I really believe that God told me my job is, well, there's several things he wants me to do, but this is one of them, to help families repair the damage. And I'm telling you, I do a lot of that, and it is just the most beautiful experience ever. And it's typically estranged families. And that breaks my heart. So if you are an estranged family, talk to me. I can really help you see this from a different angle and make you want to mend it. Because what happens in that circumstance is you believe it'll never be mended. So you just don't try anymore. And there's so many things you can do without ever calling the person. I just really believe he's put me in a spot. And I don't know why, because my family's pretty mended. But I think everybody needs to mend the family issues. And it says, is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? And that is so easy to fall into that. I mean, I don't know about you guys. I'm assuming you're like me and you're in management. And if everyone, I know how you can get through the grocery line faster. The gas pumps. Why'd you pull up like that? You screwed it up for everybody. You saw that the guy in front of you was leaving in about 30 seconds. But no, you parked in there and you wedged everybody out, you know? I mean, that is just the way my mind works. I see a lot of injustice in the world. And if not me, who, right? And then it says, you know, this delusion that we have. And what we will, where we will go with a delusion is pretty remarkable. I mean, somebody will say, would you rather be right or happy? Well, first I want to knock your head off with that stupid statement. Because if you want the truth, I want to be right. And if happiness follows, lucky me, you know. But, I mean, yeah, if somebody goes, well, I'd rather be happy. Oh, whatever. You want to be right. Come on. Right is a good spot to be. I like living in right. I like being right. I like supporting right. And but don't get me wrong. I mean, this is the new and improved Katie you're seeing, just FYI. So you can imagine what I was in life without any of this. It was something. I told my sponsor's husband, I saw him somewhere, and I said, oh, Cecil, I'm not doing very good. And he apparently told Marty, and Marty calls me. She goes, so let me get this straight. You tell my husband you're not doing well, but you haven't called me. And I thought, oh, that didn't go well. That did not go the way. Sorry. I hear you. I hear you, sister. Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Right? And you know, I got a good one for that. I'm in a dentist office, and I had a tooth kind of taken a left, and I just don't want that to happen. And so I get Invisalign, right? And I go in there, and I didn't realize I'd be with all the 13-year-old kids, you know. I mean, they just got them lined up, assembly line stuff, wires everywhere. And I'm like, oh, no, we're not doing wires. We're doing the Invisalign. I'm thinking it's no big deal. And the dentist was an athlete, and we started talking about fitness, and that was my whole career. And the next thing you know, all the girls are kind of coming in the room that work there. And I was thinking, it's because I'm so fascinating. They just want to hear what I've got to say. And so I'm just going on and on and on and on. And then I go, okay, well, I got to go. It's about 2:30. So I leave, and since I have Invisalign, I have to, you know, eat in the car. And then I thought, I'm going to come back and brush my teeth in the place. And when I came back in, the whole place was closed. Lights out, nobody home. And I realized that those people weren't listening to how fascinating I was. They were like, when is this chick going to shut up so we can get out of here? I would never have known that. Matter of fact, I would have come back and with another story. Come on in, guys. Come on. Yeah. Katie's here. I know you can't wait. I'm telling you, that's a God's honest truth. I sometimes my self-esteem is too high, and it gets me in trouble. So it says, so our troubles are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourself, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. That's a little hard pill to swallow. I'm like, extreme? I mean, come on. But the truth of the matter is, at least for me, I have to really keep my finger on the pulse of that. I like to get even, keep score, you know, whatever, whatever, whatever. I've done so well in my life without gossip. That's a doozy of a problem to be in, because I have found it just sets me up terribly. When I was 3 years sober, the girl that I was just hanging out with, another 3 years sober gal, she said, I said, my God, all we do is gossip. We just talk about everybody. And she said, we need to quit doing that. I said, okay, I'm with you. Let's try to quit. Now, we're 3 years sober. We sat there in silence for about 4 minutes. We got nothing. We got nothing to talk about unless we're talking trash about people. And I'll tell you, the problem with gossip is then all of a sudden somebody finds out that you said, and it comes back, and it bites hard when it comes back. That took a while for me to finally quit doing gossip. This self-knowledge, this awareness, it's important, right? It's important to see what drives me. It's a six-step issue, right? And the way the steps are lined out, I misunderstood so much of this, right? One and two go together. Three and four are really solid. But then what I get in that fourth, when I do that fifth step, fourth step, whatever we want to call it, tenth step, I've got to take that information and really integrate it in my 10 and 11. Right, if this behavior is objectionable to me that I have now seen that I do, I have to stay heightenedly aware of it. So I've got to really carry that into evening review, on awakening, watching throughout my day for a while. I like to take a piece of inventory into that practice for about 2 weeks till it gets a cellular spot. because it's not okay with me to be like that. And I mean, me off the chain, it's a dandy. I mean, I could just get my children here. One time I pull up, my son works at this fabulous grocery store. And, you know, he's 37. He's got a 13-year-old. He's been married for 19 years since they were 17. Amazing deal. And I'm out in the parking lot, and I got a buddy of mine that's in the program, and his son is an MMA fighter, and he was with him. And I knew my son liked the MMA, which is disturbing. And, they put that on at the gym. I'm like, turn that channel off. They just beat the crap out of each other. And so I see Sam, and he's probably as far back as those doors. I'm like, Sam! Sam! And he goes, and he just runs in the store, and I thought, what was that about? So I tell the guy, you know, maybe we'll meet another time, sorry about that, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, I go in the store, I go, what was that about? He goes, oh, Mom, I'm sorry, I thought you were yelling at somebody for taking your parking spot. That boy has never seen me drink. So, just welcome to that world. They don't have to have that, right? Challenging. That was another moment where I thought, wow, I've done some real damage in my family. I need to really, really try to pick that up. And it's better than it's ever been. I keep saying that, but I want you to understand that it is better than it's ever been. It says, God does not make too hard of terms for those who seek him, right? And those terms are not hard, right? Stay close to him, perform his work well. In order to stay close to him, I got to get close to him. In order to get close to him, I got to get unblocked. Right. If I am blocked, I couldn't hear it if you had a bullhorn. That's the nature of me. And it says God's going to be the director. He's the principal. We're his agents. He's the father. We're his children. To me, I think that's a gift. I love that. Now, that's it. That's the way I see the God of my understanding. If yours is more the spirit life, then just fit all that in there. I had done a workshop just a few weeks ago, and I didn't realize that the guy who asked me had a complete different take on the Creator and or the God of his understanding. And when we were going to the airport, he said, "Yeah, it just sounds too churchy for me." And I really took that to heart. And I thought, you know, I want to be sure that if I ever come across with that feeling for somebody, please put the God of your understanding in there, right? And if it's the spirit life, if it's Buddhism, whatever it is, just weave that in there. But don't let mine turn you off, because that would be so unfortunate to carry a message that landed hard. You know, we agnostics talk very much about trying to set aside all those things. So I just, it was kind of surprised me. I wished I would have done that a little differently. It says, most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of a new triumphant arch through which we should pass to freedom. Right? What a promise. These terms are beautiful, and they come true, but we have to seek them. We have to take the action. And it says we alcoholics are undisciplined. God disciplines us in this very way we see fit. And I'm telling you, it is remarkable. On page 47, it says, ask yourself one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he's on his way. Right? All we have is identification and power. You get to make that power be whatever you want. But you have to have those two understandings. It says, it has been repeatedly proven among us that this simple cornerstone, a wonderful, effective spiritual structure, can be built. Identification and power. And then Bill writes, my friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which would answer all my problems. That's a big statement. Answer all my problems. So there's no problem out there that's too big. And if you think it is, come talk to me. Now that I have 40 years, I can say that with confidence. I have been through a lot, and I can help somebody get through this stuff. It says, belief in a power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. And these requirements are really important to meet. You know, most of us just are very undisciplined. I love discipline. I've always loved discipline. Remember, I was in special forces. So I am very disciplined. Somewhere, I don't believe in reincarnation, but for me, I make the exception. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant the destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of light who presides over us. I think that some of Bill's writings were just remarkable, just absolutely remarkable. And he took a beat-up drunk like Bill and gave him what we so beautifully have today. It's nothing short of a miracle. I don't ever want that to be lost on me. And I've decided I want to close my talks with a love letter from Charlie. He was such a romantic. Now, he couldn't sit down and have a three-minute conversation with you, so don't get lost in that statement, right? My boy had ADHD off the chain, but he was such a romantic. And you know, it was interesting because it required a girl like me to make him be the man that he was today. I take full credit for that, just FYI. That was not an easy task. I'd known him for 20 years, trust me. It was like right in the love boat, you know? Whew, it was a slow-turning machine. And together, we were just a powerful couple. And he would write me these love letters, and I saved all of them. And so I want to end with this one. It says, "To my wife, my friend, my love, Katie, I can't even begin to tell you all the reasons that I love you, but here are three. You are so generous with people who come to you for help. You're of your family and the way you care for everyone. You are just so damn fun to be with. I am so grateful to get to hang out with you. Dang it, I'm on a roll now, but I said I'd only write three. I better stop. You are the love of my life, Charlie. Thank you. It's been an honor and a privilege." And I forgot to thank Ben and Shay Lynn. I'm out of sorts. I'm just out of sorts. Okay, I'm going.